the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country.
We are too busy for the introduction today. We got a cram-packed show. I hope you're doing well today. Welcome to School for Startups Radio. First up today, we're going to talk litigation finance with James Catulus. We're going to have fiction author Bill Combs, and then resilient parenting with Dr. Kate Lund. All great businesses. We're going to get into how a parenting expert can make money. Great show. Thanks for being with us. We're going to get started right now. So you know, we have an expression that we love here on the show. There's riches in the niches, and I think we're going to see that with our guests. Please welcome James Catulus to the show. He is the CEO of Juris Trade. It is a marketplace for litigation assets. I think that means if you want to sue someone, you can go there and get financial support. And then if you win, the people who gave you financial support win also. We will make sure that that is right. Prior to this, he has been involved in some of the huge bankruptcies that we've had in the world. He returned right at $7 billion from the MF Global bankruptcy. That's money that he was able to find and bring back for the investors. He's been on all of the big shows on CNBC, Bloomberg, CNN, Wall Street, and of course, New York Times, Fortune, Forbes, and all of the rest. James, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Great, man. Nice intro. I appreciate it.
And I will follow you around and do that every time you walk into a new room. And we also have the nighttime version with world-renowned Lover.
So that's James, incredible.
And welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. Good to be here.
So did I get that right? I want to sue the tobacco industry and I don't have the money to do it. And then you help raise the money. And then we all win if I win. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, right? I mean, like Juris Trade, you know, we founded it really to help create a secondary market in litigation to allow people to trade already originated financing, you know, because there's very different risk and return profiles depending on what phase of the case that you're in. However, we are doing a lot of, you know, origination work. You know, usually it's with law firms rather than, you know, individual plaintiffs. But, you know, we are helping some corporate plaintiffs right now get funding. You know, we've done that in a couple of different countries already. So, you know, we're happy to help where we can.
Fascinating. Can you give us an example of a deal that you've worked on? Are there any stories you are legally allowed to share?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really get into, you know, who the parties are, but, you know, we just helped monetize a NAFTA arbitration award against a sovereign nation. You know, they were found to you know, have done some illegal conduct. And as you might imagine, it can be difficult to collect against a country. You know, so we brought in some specialists where, you know, that's what they do, and, you know, how to put liens on assets of a foreign country that are held in this country and, you know, collect on those. So, you know, people went, they funded the arbitration, they got the judgment, and then, you know, they come to us to, you know, help collect for, you know, a share of those, you know, collectible proceeds.
Fascinating. And you said it's a secondary market, indicating that there's a primary market. Explain why there would be a secondary market for this asset class.
Yeah. So, you know, the primary market's about $30 billion, which, you know, by market standards is pretty small, right? Like, you know, cryptocurrency, a lot of people think of the most pioneering asset class. But that's a multi-trillion dollar market already, right? So to be at $30 billion is pretty small by, you know, financial market standards. But, you know, the problem is litigation is long duration, right? A case could take 3, 5, 7, maybe even 10 years with appeals to play out, right? You know, banks have historically not been big lenders, you know, to law firms because, you know, contingency law is very boom or bust, right? So the private credit world and litigation finance worlds have really filled that gap where they're able to do, you know, a bit more creative structures. But really before us, you could choose at what stage you would enter the case, right? You could come in day one before a complaint is filed, or, you know, a lot of funders won't come in until you defeat a motion to dismiss, which is the first major hurdle in any litigation. You know, anybody files a complaint, the other side tries to dismiss it and make it go away. So if you get through the motion to dismiss, then that's a big validation of the case. But there's other things like your expert motions, which are called jawbear, like trying to disqualify an expert and say like a mass tort case against the pharmaceutical manufacturer, or, you know, summary judgment where you get, the defense tries to defeat you as a matter of law using mutually agreed on undisputed facts, right? So, you know, each time you get through a major milestone like that, generally, you know, there's less risk in the case and, you know, usually less reward. So, you know, if someone is really good at identifying cases, then they could come in, you know, day one, you know, get very lucrative terms from a, you know, case that they're funding, and then, you know, get through the motion to dismiss, get through summary judgment, and maybe they come to us and sell part of their interest there to someone who's more risk adverse. And that's a win-win, right? So, you know, like you mentioned MF Global, right? Or, you know, I recovered you know, all $6.7 billion in client assets. I did that for free. You know, we had, you know, about $167,000 in donations, and, you know, went up against like JP Morgan, a, you know, multi-trillion-dollar bank, and like Obama's attorney general and Clinton's FBI director. Like, it's really hard to beat them, you know, on donations alone, and, you know, someone working pro bono, right? All these companies have directors and officers insurance. And, you know, huge balance sheets, right? So, you know, when you could add the liquidity to any market, it makes the cost on the other side go down, right? So, like, you know, I run a commodity hedge fund for 17 years, right? Some people say that, oh, you know, if you're trading, you know, corn futures, then you're helping food prices go up, right? Those are like the ESG advocates, but they're wrong. Right. Like, you have an entire system of regulated public markets in the U.S. to allow farmers, to allow oil producers, airlines to hedge their costs. And, you know, they depend on speculators to come in there, you know, and speculate. But that gives them the liquidity to go hedge, and that always reduces costs. Right. And it's the same thing in litigation finance. So, you know, as we bring more capital, more liquidity into the space, it helps lower, you know, the costs for people to go out and get justice against these big, you know, multi-billion or multi-trillion dollar conglomerates who, you know, have a nasty habit of breaking the law.
How did you win assets back in the MF Global situation? How do you what was the trick there? You gave a very interesting laugh there. What does that mean, James?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was, you know, pretty, you know, unconventional and intense experience. But, you know, I was 30 years old. I never took a class in bankruptcy. My litigation experience at that point was an $8,000 collection case for my golf pro buddy. But, you know, look, I had a couple clients that managed accounts there, you know, that I would do whatever I could to help them. So I filed an emergency motion asking for like 90% of their money back before we knew the extent of the shortfall there. Like, you know, John Forzine had left $1.7 billion shortfall in customer segregated accounts, which had never happened before in the U.S. And, you know, due to the unprecedented nature of this case, no one else really did anything early on. So I was first person to do anything. And, you know, like 4 days after the bankruptcy, I'm on the front page of the New York Times business section in a black trench coat looking scary. And, you know, we started getting over 1,000 phone calls a day. At that point, my hedge fund was myself, my 23-year-old little sister with an advertising degree, and a literal farmer who traded grains for us, right? You know, so it was so bad. She literally was hearing phones ringing in her sleep. We were getting so many calls, right? But, you know, one of those calls was this guy, John row. He was a commodity broker, had about 1,000 clients at MF, and his dad happened to be a congressman. And John is like, we got to write a white paper and tell the American people why this is such a big deal. Because, you had like Coca-Cola, Southwest Airlines, Coke Industries, Charles Schwab, like major, major companies had exposure to what was the world's largest non-bank commodity broker, right? So, I'm like, screw it. Let's form a nonprofit. I represented everybody for free, 38,000. So I was in court against, some of the biggest Venus lawyers, on earth. But, the judge, realized I had a lot of commodities operation experience. The trustee that was appointed was the same one from Lehman Brothers. They were really more securities guys, even though there were only a handful of securities accounts versus 30,000 commodity accounts. So they wanted to make everyone fill out like a 50-page claim form, take 9 months to process them before they got any money back, right? And I'm like, wait a second, commodity traders know they got to check their statement every day, because if there's an error and they don't catch it, they then own that error. So I'm like, look, we could use these statements as a negative consent interim claim form where, everyone sends it to the trustee sends everybody their last statement and be like, is there any errors here or not? Right. So if they don't report an error, then, they get 72% back. So, we were able to get people 4.2 billion in 6 weeks after the bankruptcy, when projections were like 3.6 billion in 9 months, right? And one of the little tricks in bankruptcy is, the longer it goes on, the more fights, because the assets become scarcer, and then you got lawyers billing on both sides. So then that depletes the assets, and they're essentially exponentially depleted the longer it goes. So by getting that out early, we saved millions and millions of dollars of, bankruptcy fees. And then, I went to the media. I like go on CNBC. I'm like, hey, JP Morgan's got 5 major conflicts in this bankruptcy, right? They were the clearing and settlement agent for MF Global. They had lent them $1.2 billion to trade on. They were the custodian of the customer funds. They bought their London Metals Exchange stock out of the bankruptcy estate, right? And, I just hammered them and embarrassed them until Jess Staley, the guy who apparently was responsible for funding Epstein, Jess Staley got pissed and had my bank accounts and credit cards closed. So I got like debanked 10 years before Kanye got debanked. So you really say Kanye got Cthulhu's, right, by JP Morgan. But we were able to then make that go viral. Like I tweeted the letter closing my accounts, and Business Insider had a story written and published within 12 minutes. New York Times covered it. I declared war on them in Forbes. I organized a boycott, went to different custody banks to try to take all of their futures custody business away from them. And, basically just, attack JP Morgan on every single front until they were like, okay, pay the customers their $1 billion and get this guy out of our hair. And then everyone fought over like the holding company, which had more money. So,
wow, what a story.
Yeah. But listen, back to... it really should be a movie.
The actor from Suits? Did you ever watch that?
Yeah,
show?
Harvey.
Yeah, of course. You look like Paul Harvey, don't you?
I mean, I'll take it, man. Okay. Thanks. I'm not German, but
I thought you kind of did. Your picture's not that close up, but.
I'll take it. I'm a little darker than him, but hey, I call a lot worse. So thank you. Oh, absolutely. I love that show.
How realistic is it?
It's more realistic than you would think. But they take some liberties, especially with like timings, right? Like they act you file a motion like an hour before court and then it's heard. And, there's all these like surprise gotchas and stuff. Like, the legal system is really set up with, usually any kind of motion, you got 2 weeks to respond to, right? I mean, emergency motion maybe is one thing, but no one's like doing an emergency motion to dismiss. And, they love that narrative device on the show.
Well, those commercials are longer than you think, James. All right. Named top crypto rock star on Wall Street by Business Insider, you were. I left that out of the intro so I could save it for now. What's going on in the crypto market right now, and what are your thoughts? You're part of the a coin, aren't you? Didn't you have one of your own coins?
Yeah, well, Brandon, so that's a... Yeah, so it's funny. On the 10-year anniversary of MF Global, which coincidentally happened on Halloween 2011, right, I dressed up as the Let's Go Brandon meme. A friend of mine on Instagram said that should be a coin. Someone made it. It went ultra viral. I wound up getting President Trump into crypto, Candace Owens, several congressional members, and we were approved by NASCAR to be the lead sponsor of the original Brandon's car. Then, Comcast and Xfinity got pissed, started calling NASCAR, and they went out to the media and lied and said that they never approved it, despite us having, written approval to that fact. And, the decision came down from the president and the chairman, of NASCAR. So that has now spawned, three lawsuits. It's probably going to be up to five lawsuits. Hopefully, at some point we get back it's about $571 million in damages that, NASCAR caused by maliciously revoking that sponsorship and then lying about it to the Washington Post, among other places. So that's been a fun 3 years. Hopefully it's resolved within 5 years. We'll see.
My goodness, James. So is it a valid token now? Are people trading it, or is it?
Yeah. It's called Let's Go. One word on ERC-20. Price is pretty low right now. We actually went to trial on like the first of the seven or so, counts there. And the jury ruled that NASCAR did approve it, but then they're like, oh, but NASCAR should have expected us to change our behavior based on it and didn't give us any damages. So, we're trying to, fix that. And, that case was just on behalf of the Let's Go Brandon.com Foundation. There's other suits pending on behalf of all coin holders for, intentionally tarnishing the rep and the value of the coin. So, it has been a mess, but, legally, I think the case is pretty clear. And, I think eventually we should get a pretty big win against them.
Potentially $100 million type win.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not in the nine figures, I think a lot of people will be disappointed. But, there's still quite a slog left on that one.
Right. And so that's on behalf of the coin holders?
Yeah, correct. So, the first kind of mini trial was just the Cayman Islands Let's Go Brandon.com Foundation versus NASCAR off promissor estoppel, which is them promising to approve the sponsorship and then us detrimentally relying on it because they then lied about it. But there's also some defamation like and associated claims that are still pretty early stage.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're always in the thick of it, James.
I don't know. I think I'm a pretty nice guy, but for whatever reason I get I attract some some bad actors. But look, all these experiences are why I'm so passionate about litigation finance. I mean, like an MF Global type situation, you don't get pro bono lawyers come along very much, let alone ones who could beat, the biggest, baddest, banks in the world. And, litigation finance helps, level that playing field, right? And, the crazy thing is, lately, private credit has been all the rage, right? You've got, institutions have about $3 trillion in demand for private credit, and there's simply not enough just, traditional loans, loans to consumers, loans to businesses, out there. So, now we've been structuring, notes for them, where we actually go out, we lend, to various, large litigation cases, and then go get insurance wrappers so that the, their principals insured their, even interest rate is insured. So, you know, the cost of capital is high enough in that litigation world where it's a very compelling to use some of that yield and go buy that insurance and, you know, set it up just like, you know, a regular note that a bond investor would buy.
How do you divide your time and manage time? It seems like you have several balls in the air.
Yeah, you know, look, I got 35 great staff members. You know, so a lot of it is I'm coming up with ideas, I'm designing, you know, structures, and then, you know, the staff is, you know, executing that, right? And, you know, on top of the direct staff, we've got, you know, compliance consultants and, you know, I've got, I don't know, probably have 50 plus lawyers. You know, I work with in, you know, various capacities, you know, both on litigation side and transactional. So, you know, a lot of business and just, you know, scaling your time is finding great people to work with and having them, you know, kind of carry out the vision.
Right. Nice when there's a team.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like our, you know, our core hedge fund business, Typhon Capital, you know, we've been running that for 17 years, have 16 groups of portfolio managers. They all trade, you know, very esoteric, you know, instruments, you know, like commodities. We've got a crypto fund. You know, we do like high frequency quant trading, you know, a lot of really differentiated strategies. So, you know, I don't really have much use day to day, like, you know, telling our metals PMs who've been trading since 1987, you know, what to do in gold today, right? So it's, you know, we get them capital, we set up their, you know, investment vehicles, we've got risk managers, you know, watching them, and then, you know, they're able to execute, you know, themselves. And I just think that that's a core way that I manage everything we do. And, you know, it's much superior than, you know, micromanage and, you know, trying to make every decision in every asset class myself.
That's good advice. Absolutely fascinating, James. I am always excited to learn a new industry, and that I have done. How do we find out more, follow you online, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Look, you know, my ancestors shorted my Greek name to only 9 letters, but, you know, I can spell it out. You know, I'm basically at James, KOUTOULAS, on every major, you know, social network, Twitter, Instagram, you know, and LinkedIn, you leave the space out. But, yeah, feel free to hit me up, ask any questions, and, you know, always trying to help people out as we can.
Thank you so much. And we will be right back. Welcome back to the show again. Thank you so much for being with us. Bill Combs is our next guest. Please welcome him to the show. He is living the dream that so many of us want to have a life as an author. He is writing both fiction and nonfiction. He has a new fiction product called The Quantum Gate. It is released and has a 2-part in the series already. Bill, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you so much, Jim. Doing great. Thank you.
Tell us the things you're writing about right now. Tell us about The Quantum Gate in particular. 5-star rated on Amazon with 60 5-star reviews. Congratulations. Tell us about it.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It's Quantum Gate is sort of a culmination of my reading and studying and vivid imagination since I was a child. It's about, you know, it's a metaphysical thriller, so it brings in metaphysical ideas and talks about, you know, what if the legendary Hall of Records, that repository of ancient knowledge, existed, and what would happen
if Friends or Alexandria?
Actually, it's neither.
Okay.
It's sort of like a descendant of Alexandria, but it was actually talked about back in the 20s by Edgar Casey. He was the one who mentioned it. And so I actually kind of wove that part of it into the story as well. And so it's just it's a repository. People have speculated what it is, whether it's a, you know, a different dimension or just literally a repository of books and scrolls. I took a particular, spin on that and kind of went with what I thought it was and created this idea of what would happen if you were a quantum physicist and you kind of stepped out of bounds and became obsessed with something that clearly was not a fundamental scientific idea. And what would that look like? What would that do to your life? How would that affect you? Throw in a little bit of personal grief and loss. And, we have a story that kind of starts out on a very strong emotional, footing and you travel to Egypt. You follow this man with his daughter as they try to unravel this idea of the Hall of Records. And what they discover really kind of, shatters a lot of who they are to the core and opens up all types of interesting questions for the reader.
Is that in the foot of the Sphinx, or I've heard, is that the,
yeah.
Okay. So
yes,
this is a Hall of Records that hides in the Sphinx.
That's the legend.
What I actually had to write about
may not be the same, but yes. It's the one under the Sphinx. Yes.
Okay, great. That is interesting. Oh wow. We can go all sorts of places with this. I'm fascinated by Egyptian engineering and technology, all of that. How old do you think the pyramids are, Bill, and what do you think they are for?
Based on my research, I don't really know what they're for. There's so many ideas and some of them all have validity, but age wise, based on what we've seen lately, I'm placing them at about 15 to 20,000 years old, which is roughly five times what the common accepted age is.
Yes. What's his name? Yossi Hawass?
Yes. I don't think he's there anymore. No, he's not going to like me.
Okay.
No, he's not. But yeah.
What do you think the use was? I'm going power plant. What are your thoughts?
I'm actually leaning towards that as well. There's been a lot of ideas about it, the way it's organized, the geometric components of it. This idea of this biogeometry has come around today. I believe it was some kind of a power plant or some kind of energetic center. What it was exactly, I don't know. I investigate ideas in the book, but it's kind of the beauty of fiction is I get to explore things the way I want to.
Right. And do you believe that there is that huge area underneath the pyramids, 2 kilometers
Yes,
deep?
Yes. I kind of took that and created a very specific type of idea around that. Again, fictionalized it, but it's definitely part of the book. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, I want to read it because I agree with all of your wacko conspiracy theories. What both of us believe do firmly put us into conspiracy land, I'm afraid. In today's world. Though I think the power plant idea is gaining popularity pretty quickly, don't you think?
It is, based on just some basic data they've been working on. I mean, obviously nothing's proven categorically yet, but there's a lot of evidence leading in that direction. So we'll see how it unfolds.
Yes. All right. Let's switch gears, Bill. Congratulations on a life as an author. How do you do that? How do you make enough money to eat? How do you write books? How do you get ideas? How do you find publishers? I want to hear the whole process. So educate us on how to become a successful author. I think you've got 4 books out now. Is that correct?
I've got 4 out. Yep. And I've got 2 more in the works.
Talk to us, answer all 18 of my questions. Go.
All right. I guess for me, stories have always been a thing for me. Even when I was a kid, I loved stories of all types, and I've been a big, I've been very interested in metaphysics in both even in standard science and metaphysics. I've always felt that those things are just opposite sides of the same coin. And so, I've studied them both voraciously over my life, and I've basically, I had a good friend of mine who was an author, and he was encouraging me to consider trying it. And so I did. I put together, my first book was just a nonfiction book. It kind of represented my personal philosophy, which I lectured about here locally. And the process was interesting and unique. And I had to really kind of dive in and learn a lot about it. And I then went ahead and decided to do a novel. And I wanted to kind of write the story that I used to daydream about when I was a kid, which was finding the Hall of Records. And so I put it together, wrote it, went through the process that all authors go through. I decided to write the story based on what I wanted it to be. And the first couple drafts really didn't grab the attention of people that I had looking at it. And I had to kind of shift gears and decide to let the characters write the story. And as somebody who's an avid meditator, I went ahead and kind of let that kind of come to me, rewrote the whole thing, and much better. It made a lot more sense. It flowed better. There's a lot more emotional, currency there to really kind of latch onto. And it really kind of exploded, because when I finished the book, I was like, well, we have a lot more story to tell. And so I was going to go ahead and write a couple more for this series. What I had to learn to be a successful author is one of those relative terms, because you could be successful making, a small four figure per month salary. You could be successful if you make $1 million a year. I am looking really more to be just successful, to kind of be able to do this for a living. I'm happy with that. And I have so many ideas to put into books that I feel like that's going to just come naturally. I love storytelling. I love the idea of metaphysics and fiction kind of married together. I feel like that's an incredibly powerful way to help get ideas to people, that, people will not shut down when you mention something that's not quite in their wheelhouse. They'll be more open to it in fiction. And so I feel to be fiction is a very valuable way of kind of getting ideas out there. In the meantime, I had to become an expert at advertising and creating images and, social media posts, and just trying to drum a pipe. I mean, the biggest challenge to being an author is you can have the best book on the planet. It's just getting the right people to see it. And I can tell you that that's still a challenge for me. It's just finding those right levers to pull to get the right people to see your book. Once you have the right people seeing it, they love it.
All right. How do you physically write? Do you type on a computer? Do you write on
computer.
A long Okay. Do you dictate
no, computer.
Or do you actually type?
Well, both. I've used both, but on a computer for sure. I mean, I'm an IT guy, so that's really kind of I'm comfortable there. I use a computer. I have used, when putting together my cover and having had a cover design put together by a person for the Quantum Gate that I really loved. And it's just trying to, and I've got some great tools like formatting tools, because it's crazy how strict you have to be in formatting the manuscript to get it to fit in Amazon's print or Ingram's print or Kindle's print or any of these other things. So you have to have a great tool to do that. And then just being able to proof your work and getting people to review it.
Publisher?
No publisher, doing it independently. I had a publisher kind of do something, kind of distribute it a little bit for the Quantum Gate, but I wasn't really happy with how they did that. So I've been doing almost all of it on my own.
Has that made a difference?
The publisher, I think, didn't really help me at all. Doing it on my own, I think, makes a difference, because I really care and I'm able to talk with people and do some, public appearances here locally. And I feel like it's been a much better way for me. I can only speak for myself, but for me, it's been a much better path to follow.
Okay.
And again, being an IT guy, using these tools, playing around with, things like KDP for Amazon and these different solutions, they're all very easy for me to pick up. So other people who don't have that skill set might find a publisher to be much more valuable.
Well, I've done it both ways, and I am, good at computers, but I'm not a tech guy by any means. And I watched enough YouTube videos that I was able to get it done. And
yep.
So that's certainly doable. I would agree. I would certainly agree with you on that. I noticed your books are 250-ish pages. One of the things that I have seen and researched and stuff is that most books it read up until a page 100. And, you know, yeah. Amazon can track that kind of stuff now. And Amazon yep. is saying that books should be 100 pages. What are your thoughts on this? Would you do that? Would you do it differently? Or have you thought about that? And Bill, I've released 5, 2 fiction and 3 nonfiction, and I'm going to do 3 fiction next, but that is a 500 page document that I wrote, and everyone's telling me to release it in 3 parts.
What are 3 parts? Yeah. I would say for me, my nonfiction is generally smaller. It's about 150 to 200 pages. And I feel like that's pretty reasonable. I kind of look at it differently. I'm a voracious reader. I want the story that's being told to me that I'm reading to have, you know, a logical and emotionally, you know, good beginning and a solid conclusion. So I don't spend a lot of time figuring out how long the book is. I write the book, and if it comes in between 250 and 350 pages, I'm good. And I haven't seen too many problems with that. Even on with the Quantum Gate, which is on Kindle Unlimited, I still get 30,000, 40,000 pages read a month.
Okay. But I'm wondering if there's 20,000 pages that they're not reading. You know, because they just
say, possible,
oh, I
yeah.
get this book now and I'm going to move on. You know, that's just what the data is telling us. And it's fascinating to me. So I'm going to try it differently this time and see what happens. And
see what happens. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Bill, appreciate you being with us. And I love your genre. I'm fascinated by anything about the pyramids. I probably will read this here over the holidays. How do we get in touch and find out more?
It's very simple. Just go to BillCombs.com.
Fantastic. COMBS.
Correct.
Fantastic. Bill, I wish you a happy holiday season, happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for being with us.
Right back at you, Jim. Take care.
And we'll be right back. We're going to talk about resilient parenting right after this. We are back in again. Thank you so much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Dr. Kate Lund to the show. She is a psychiatrist, a podcaster, an author, and very successful at all of them. She has a new book out called Step Away, The Keys to Resilient Parenting, has over 100 five-star reviews on that website called Amazon. She is also very active in teaching resilience. And that's hopefully one of the things that we will talk about. Her podcast is called The Optimized Mind. Welcome, Dr. Lund. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much. And one thing I just wanted to clarify, I'm a psychologist, not a psychiatrist.
I'm sorry. Good. Thank you for that. I'm sorry.
What's the difference? No worries.
Psychiatrists give out pills.
Exactly. A psychiatrist is an MD and they prescribe meds and, you know, do some counseling too, but primarily the focus is on medication. Whereas I'm a psychologist, so at the doctoral level, so I have a PhD in psychology and, you know, see clients, do therapy, teach, research, that sort of thing.
But the seeing the therapy or the patients is the same goal, right?
Exactly. Yes.
As a psychiatrist. Just without the drugs.
Exactly. Okay. Precisely. Yeah. To optimize well-being, mental health, and psychological function, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay. Isn't the drugs the bad part? Isn't that what's screwing people up?
You know, it all depends. I that. Yeah. Not my expertise, but, you know, sometimes folks really do need them, you know?
Well, that's true. Yes. I'm not going to deny that. But it seems like all of the mood drugs come with a warranty, a warning that they also cause suicidal thoughts.
Well, yeah, again, not my expertise, but
contradiction right there.
But there are certainly side effects related, and there can be, and they can play out in various ways, different ways.
Okay. What kept you from yelling today?
What kept me from yelling?
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm not much of a yeller, to be honest. So,
is that the name of your TED talk?
No, my TED talk is finding the ordinary in extraordinary.
Okay. I'm on your website or your page, and I'm confused. Anyway, it says this kept me from yelling today. I thought that would be interesting.
Huh. Weird. I wonder which page that is.
It's on your about and your LinkedIn page.
Huh. Very strange. Well, yeah, I will have to take a look at that. But yeah, no, my TED talk is about helping kids who struggle with a medical challenge to find the ordinary within those extraordinary circumstances.
Okay. Let's talk about the book and start talking about parenting. What are the key takeaways from the new book? Again, 100 five-star reviews. Congratulations. Resilient parenting. I have 4 children. I'm ready to kill 2 of them. Help me be resilient.
Yeah, so absolutely. Thanks. The book is, super exciting project. And really, it's a roadmap for us as parents to optimize our well-being by becoming as resilient as possible within our own unique context. And that's going to look different for all of us across, our different experiences and domains and that sort of thing. But first and foremost, important for us to manage or modulate our stress response as parents, as people. So we want to try to show up as level as possible each and every day. And that takes practice and optimization. And so I teach folks a very simple technique derived from something created by Dr. Herbert Benson, a physician in Boston back in the late 70s. And the relaxation response is something where you come up with a word or a phrase that you find soothing in some way, and you breathe. And you're starting to integrate what it feels like to be in that stress-modulated space. So very, very important for us as parents, because if we're starting the day in a heightened state of anxiety, stress, et cetera, and we hit a challenge or an obstacle, we're going to escalate to the point of shutdown. And then we're not going to be very good for anything or anyone. So we want to show up level. That's the first principle that we outline in the book.
All right. That is hard. Parents are people, and people are not level. So how do we maintain that levelness when, kid just wrecked the car?
Yeah, really, really hard, right? And in those moments, so first thing is practicing a technique like this or this very technique consistently in the morning and in the evening so that we can integrate it.
And think my happy word.
Yeah, okay. Integrating that into our baseline. But we can also take it with us in our back pocket so that the kid comes home, they say they've wrecked the car. You think of the word. You take a actual step back, you give yourself space to get to that level spot. And so then you're more able to respond acting off the cuff because, these challenges are going to come up and wrecking the car is probably something that could potentially push a parent to react as opposed to respond in a way that they would be more proud of.
Yes. And so what do you do when you make a mistake? And you're not level. Do you apologize to your children?
Absolutely. Yep. Because we're people, right? And there's no perfect in any of this. These are just things that we're hoping to move towards. But yeah, there's no perfect in any of it. And we're going to make mistakes. And there are going to be moments when we're not as level as we'd like to be. And we react in a way that we wish we hadn't or we aren't proud of. And yeah, absolutely. We want to be able to apologize in those moments to our kids. We want to be able to connect always with our children in an authentic way and admit when we've made a mistake or we wish we'd done something different.
I contend that the 20-year-olds, and I always get confused what generation they are because it seems like we're producing a new generation every 5 years, not every 20 years, But the 20-year-olds, I would contend, have almost zero ability to apologize.
What are your thoughts? That's interesting. That's really, really interesting. And I would argue that it's case dependent on who the kid is and maybe, I guess, kind of in terms of the generation, maybe it's harder.
Employees as well. Kids, employees, just 20-year-olds.
Yeah, and very possible, but I do think it's case dependent because I think it's, you know, based on who the kid is, what their disposition is, what's been modeled at home, what's been kind of discussed with them in terms of when they've made a mistake. Because I personally know plenty of 20-year-olds who are able to apologize, admit when they need to shift gears.
Those have been through your counseling, Kate. Those aren't fair.
Yeah, I mean, possibly, but I know others out there, but I also know others who aren't. So I get it. It's a thing, but I think it's really dependent on what's being modeled at home and also dispositionally dependent, because some kids are just wired more naturally to gravitate to what they're observing, and some just are gonna bail, blow it off, you know, and be stuck in that space of always thinking they're right.
What do you do when you have an employee or a child like that?
Oof, not an easy answer, right? If it's an employee, you know, you've got to start to try to help this person shift the behavior. And if it becomes apparent that the behavior is not able to be shifted, you know, maybe it's not the best spot for the person to be working. So that's one angle.
All right, what if it's your child?
But if it's your child, you know, it's again, a question of really trying to sit down with them at 20 developmentally. They're able to engage in discussion and trying to lay out what a better angle, what a better approach would be. But there too, there's a point where it's not possible to get inside the mind and behaviors of other people. So you can only, as a parent, do the very best you can. Kind of demonstrating and talking through what a better choice would be for your kid.
All right. So be as level as possible, number one. What next, Kate?
Well, we need to understand ourselves as people, as parents, to know what we need to function at our best within our own unique context. But there's some things that everybody needs in some way. So that self-awareness is number two after we come up level. But then we need social support. We need community. We need to engage in some way with other people. That's really going to help us to build resilience and be at our best. We need to be engaging in something each day that sparks, even if it's just a short moment of joy, something that brings that spark of happiness, because oftentimes we're moving so fast through life, we forget to do that. And that can be damaging over time, leading to burnout, et cetera, et cetera. We also want to try to engage in a hobby, something that's going to get us into a space where we're focused on something outside of ourselves, in a sense, that helps us to feel better, be better. So those are the next steps. We also want to really be focused on understanding how our behavior out in the world towards our kids is impacting others, and then helping our kids, and we have already kind of touched on this, understand how their behavior, their way of being out in the world, is impacting others. So there's that emotional intelligence component that's really important to develop.
Yes. Understanding yourself and then understanding how you impact others. It's so hard to do, especially with kids involved. Is parenting changing right now? Or, you know, over these last generations? Is it changing for the good or for the worse?
Well, I definitely think it's changing because there's so many more stressors coming into the mix. There's so much, right, that just wasn't a thing back in earlier generations. And social media is driving a lot of that. So it's definitely changing. And I would argue that not always in a good way, But it's not all bad, right? There are opportunities that come with such change. But I think we have to be really careful in managing the aspects of it that can make it harder, like social media and the comparison trap that we can fall into as parents. Really, really important to not do that, to not compare ourselves to others, to really try to be looking at what is our context as a parent, as a person, and trying to optimize within that. Easier said than done when so much is coming at us through the media, through social media, all the time.
Yes, because everyone else is perfect and living perfect lives.
Right. And that's not true, but right. It looks that way, right? And so it's really important to be discerning when we're seeing all those perfect pictures and perfect images and perfect lives out on social media. Because oftentimes those are curated. And to
Oftentimes, every time. I mean, they're all just lies. See, it's like, and the more the people put out, the more likely they are to be abusing those kids behind the scenes, it seems. You know, these parenting bloggers to me are, you know, seems to be a very hypocritical group.
Yeah, yeah, it's the perfection that's put out there is just simply not real. And we have to be really careful in terms of how we're allowing that to make us feel, right? So that's why really understanding and knowing ourselves in a way that allows us to know what we need to be at our best and to just focus on that, because that's going to help our kids be at their best, because we'll be modeling naturally for them and also connecting in that authentic way. So that's really, really important.
Yes, very, very true. What about our legacy and the future? How do we pass this along and pass resilience to others?
Well, through that authentic human connection, through another really important aspect outlined in the book of how we can be resilient, how we can be at our best, is finding a way to give back and modeling that for our kids as well. So it can be anything, you know, it can be volunteering at a local food bank. It can be something a little bit more involved. For example, I take my dog out to Seattle Children's Hospital. He's part of the animal assisted therapy team out there. And that's a really awesome way for us to give back and kind of model what it means to give back for our kids here, my kids. So that is a powerful way to kind of cement or integrate legacy into the idea of optimizing well-being, building resilience, and being at your best so that you can give your best to others, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yes. Well, I think this is the most difficult thing on earth, being a parent. There's nothing more difficult. So thank you for your help. How do we get in touch, find out more about you, get a copy of the best-selling book?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is available on my website, www.katelundspeaks.com, or it's available on Amazon. And, you know, I'm available also through my website and through LinkedIn. It's a great way to get in touch with me.
Fantastic. Dr. Lund, thank you so much for being with us, and Godspeed to you and your children.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We are out of time for today, but you know what we do. That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe. Take care. Bye now.